We have Yannick on the podcast and we're already kind of talking about how to make Dolby angry.
Well,
I think we have quite some experience in that, so no worries.
<That's
brilliant>. Welcome everybody to the January episode of Spatial Audio Monthly, our podcast where we talk about all things spatial audio. I'm your host, Michael Wagner, and next to me is my co-host, Sam Hawking. I think you're here.
Hello, everybody. Yep.
And today we have a really interesting guest, Yannick Greve from the Fraunhofer Institute. And we're going to talk about MPEG-H and all things MPEG-H a little bit later. First, let's Yannick talk a little bit about, can you introduce yourself? What are you doing at Fraunhofer?
Thanks, Michael and Sam. Very pleased to have you here. Quite a big pleasure to have the possibility to speak about MPEG-H and Fraunhofer and what we're doing. So as you already said, my name is Yannick Greve. I'm working at the Fraunhofer Institute for Integrated Circuits based in Erlangen in Germany, in the northern part of Bavaria. And we are an institute. We're actually the biggest institute of the Fraunhofer, the Fraunhofer Society. And we are working on everything related to audio. So that means audio codecs, especially. So this is something we started 30 years ago, more than 30 years ago, starting with MP3 and all the successes of MP3. And now we're in the fourth generation of audio codecs. And this is where I'm mainly working on for MPEG-H audio. So I used to be a sound engineer coming from productions, starting to do research more than 10 years ago on immersive audio and reproduction technologies, or actually starting with microphone systems for production of immersive audio, and doing developments in that regard and also in signal processing. Then continue to do a lot of productions with major partners such as Eurovision Song Contest, if people have known about that. It's quite famous in Europe.
You would be surprised. It's actually famous in the United States as well.
Nice.
It particularly with the LGBT community for some reason. I have a couple of students who are big fans of the Eurovision Song Contest, and we always have a blast about it.
Yeah, that's nice. I think it's actually the biggest live music show in the world. So it's quite a big thing. We also produced a couple of other content and productions like Rock in Rio together with our partners in Brazil, European Athletics Championships. And I was mainly doing, being the system architect, system designer, but also working on the production itself, making sure that, personalized and immersive sound is being produced. And just recently I'm working more on the, market deployment and business development, and trying to spread the word on MPEG-H and bringing it more into the market, and give the people the chance to enjoy personalized immersive audio.
And this is what we're going to talk about later in this podcast episode. So we are going to have some time to touch on all kinds of things with regarding MPEG-H. And I also want to talk a little bit about Fraunhofer, because Fraunhofer in kind of the mindset of many people is primarily kind of audio focused, but that's actually a huge thing. So we will have a chance to talk about that as well. But before we do that, as we do always, every month, we are going to talk about new stuff, what happened over the last month. And Sam, what did happen? And by the way, Yannick, feel free to jump in and kind of join the discussion. We're going to talk about Atmos a little bit, so you might want to kind of touch about get that point across that MPEG-H is a good alternative. But Sam, so what's new? What has happened over the last couple of months?
Sure.
A couple of weeks, really.
Yeah, I mean, Christmas and stuff's got in the way, and I haven't had my nose to the ground as closely as I normally do with stuff that's going on. But I think what we didn't cover last time, I think it probably only just come out, was 5.2 Dolby Atmos Renderer, which is pretty pretty minor update other than they now remove spatial coding on the studio side, so on the rendering side. So I don't know whether that's to align it all with the internal renderers, maybe. But that's interesting. So nothing changes on the consumer side. That's still spatially coded. I'm not sure the reason of removing it from the studio, but I can only assume it's because ultimately they're looking at comparing it to the internal renderers, which I don't think have spatial coding. Mainly as a performance increase as well, I think they're possibly looking at ways to record live through the renderer. And at the moment, the latency is far too high to be able to do that. So I think that's possibly a reason as well. A few other little updates in that, but yeah, that's the main kind of change. If you are
You got very excited about the Windows check integration. Is this something that?
I should probably say I had a small involvement because I was asked to beta test the inclusion of the fixing of the bug where you couldn't use Jack Audio, which was Jack Audio is like a server audio solution, similar to Dante really, for Windows, Linux, Mac, and it never really allowed you to make use of all the channels that Jack could create in a virtual input output. I'm pretty sure now that all works. So that's really useful for Windows users, even though Dolby don't support Windows officially for the Dolby Atmos renderer. It does allow you to get like the 129 channels between your door and.
So you now can route the. Essentially, there's an alternative to the Dolby Audio Bridge on a Mac, right? So you can do that. But it's still not particularly useful because you don't have the music panel, right? So that's the one thing that's still missing.
So so we'll mark them down that they keep bringing out updates, but without a panner, it's useless. So.
Dolby, what are you doing? We need the music panel on Windows. We all have everything else.
You can only use their renderer on Windows or on the same system as your DAW if you use Pro Tools or I think DaVinci Resolve, because they're the only DAWs that send the metadata across. So that's it.
Oh, okay. So I didn't know that they actually.
Yeah. So the Dolby panel.
Pro Tools first.
The Dolby panel would allow you to use it in any DAW, but Pro Tools, I think, sends out the metadata to the external renderer.
It has to anyway,
how it currently works.
Okay.
And DaVinci Resolve definitely does.
Quite frankly, when I work with Nuendo, the problem is that it technically should be able to do that. However, Nuendo crashes if I choose the Dolby renderer to be on the same system. So essentially, then Nuendo just says, I don't want to. And I haven't tested Pro Tools if that actually works with Pro Tools, but it might. There's actually no particular reason why it shouldn't.
Yeah, it wasn't part of my kind of beta testing. I was purely looking at it from the Jack Audio side. But since that has happened, VB Audio have released a 512 and a 1024 virtual interface as well. So in an A and a B pairing. So that means you can use 512 channels on the DAW and 512 on the renderer. So there's multiple solutions now.
I haven't tested. Did you test it? You're talking about VB Audio Matrix.
Yeah,
right?
VB Audio Matrix. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, there's two versions. I think it's Coconut and there's one other. It's just a 512. So 64, 128, 512, or 1024 channels. Which
they called it.
If you're using 1024 channels in a mix, then you must be doing several orchestras at once, I think.
Yeah, that's kind of weird. So they called it Coconut. I like the naming scheme. The last time I looked at it, it was still in beta phase, so I haven't actually looked at it since it was.
They have a slightly strange setup because you can buy it, but you can also get it all free as well. So. I think it just depends which of their two websites you end up on.
Well, I mean, that business model works for them, right? I mean, it's the same thing with the other stuff that they're doing, that you can essentially use it for free.
See it quite a lot now where you've got kind of a donation style sales where you can contribute if you want to, yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was a big change in the Atmos. I think that
we didn't talk about it because we originally didn't think it was such a big deal. But my feeling was that the fact that the Jack now works, I think that that's something that got us very excited.
Yeah. So if they really integrated it, at the port audio level, that Jack also allows sync over audio as well. So that would theoretically, that would replace the need for LTC as well. But that would be Jack's own kind of protocol, I think, for that, or port audio. But anyway, yeah, it's good to see that something's changing there. But yeah, without the VST or AU plugin, without the VST or AAX plugins for Windows, it's pretty much useless. I'm surprised
that nobody has probably a copyright issue or an IP issue, but I mean, yeah. We looked at the communication, right? And it's not that complicated to decode. So somebody with a little bit of understanding should know how to do a panel that can actually communicate.
Yeah, anyone out there is good with, is it Fiddler or Wireshark? You could probably reverse engineer it, but...
So if anybody out there kind of knows that, hit us up on our Discord server. I'm going to leave some links in the description below and get in touch with us. Maybe we can kind of do something.
Yeah, we can pay him beer or something. That's fine.
and get Dolby angry.
Yeah, probably. I'm sure people have done it. It's just that it's not obviously something you want to make public.
I'm not sure.
I think Mac1 have got something. He did say that they've got some tools that aren't public, but they do use it. So anyway.
we have Yannick on the podcast, and we're already kind of talking about how to make Dolby angry.
I
think we have quite some experience in that, so no worries.
Brilliant. Moving on, I mean, there was Pro Tools. Okay, sorry, it's all Atmos again, I'm afraid, Yannick. Pro Tools released the internal renderer, and from what I can tell, pretty much everybody that was using the external renderer that has tried it aren't particularly happy. I'm just going because I'm on a few sort of Atmos engineer groups, and the main complaints were the IO mapping doesn't remain consistent between sessions that they've done with the external renderer and then bringing them into the internal renderer, which means working from home or on the move and then taking it into the studio to use on the external renderer, all that mapping has to be redone every time.
Oh, geez.
So I'm sure that's probably more a Pro Tools configuration issue.
I haven't looked at it yet in detail. The only thing that I noticed is that working with the internal renderer in Pro Tools doesn't seem to give a lot of advantages. You still need to set. I mean, one of the things that is nice about the internal renderers in Nuendo and Studio One, right, and Logic, is that you don't have to worry too much about the routing.
Yeah.
And with Pro Tools, there isn't much difference, quite frankly. I felt it's almost the same, right? So it's this extra step of running a separate application that's just a minor additional inconvenience, but that gives you so many advantages over the internal renderer that I wasn't quite sure if that was a good approach.
Yeah, I think it's possibly the pro Atmos Studio engineer is looking at how to use it quite a bit differently from more of a consumer or just bedroom studio engineer that's just trying to get into Atmos. They're not aware of how it works on the external side, so I think there's a bit of a misunderstanding of really where Pro Tools market is there a little bit. So I mean, the main complaints are everything that's not there in the internal renderer that is on the external, which means if you are a professional with the external renderer, moving between the two is not seamless, which is, I think, what they were hoping it would be.
That's awful.
I can run through, but
I think you need to have, because that's actually something that came up with a student that I'm currently supervising for an independent study, and she wanted to look into that. But that requires the ultimate. So it's not in the studio version of Pro Tools, right? Do you need the
For the
internal renderer in Pro Tools, you need actually the Ultimate, Pro Tools Ultimate, right?
I don't think so. No, I think it's the next tier down. I've stopped subscribing to Pro Tools, so I'm not up to date on this particular release. I think you can go down to is it the studio, the next level down? I think it's Pro Tools Studio level.
They have two versions now. Yeah, it's utterly confusing, but they have two versions now.
But I'm not sure on the internal render. I know the external you could use, but anyway.
I maintain a Pro Tools license because in our university, the music industry program, kind of they are exclusively Pro Tools.
So
I just looked it up. It's also in the studio.
Up as well. My eyes would be wandering on my third
screen. So it is indeed then kind of targeted at the less professional users then.
So I think there's definitely a
makes sense
a difference there. So yeah, the main points are there's no personalized HRTF like there is on the external. There's no MP4 render export. There's no loudness measurement. I've mentioned the mapping, and there seems to be quite a lot of
the speaker calibration probably doesn't exist.
None of that. And there's seems to be issues with object V-bed synchronization, but I think that's possibly more of a Pro Tools issue because the way they handle their latency offsets. It kind of has a maximum, I think, buffer, and if you go over that with certain plugins in the plugin chain while you're rendering, it throws the sync out, apparently. I mean, it's great that it's been included, I guess, for people that need it, but it's probably not ideal for professionals. The other products, Punch from Red Rock, came out, which is yet another up to 9.1.6 plugin. So that's Punch is based on kind of the Neve channel strips, like analog style channel strips, which is, I can't think of any other multi-channel kind of analog flavored channel strips that you could put into a multi-channel workflow. Obviously it'd work with MPEG-H as well.
It might actually, kind of that's one of the things I was thinking of, because the Red Rock Sound plugins, the immersive plugins, are so flexible in how you assign channels to individual, how you group them essentially. Which to me actually almost lends them towards something that is like MPEG-H. All their plugins actually should be perfectly fine.
They've got some. Like cube and quad, so they've got not just the typical sort of surround speaker layout. So that I've used it for some Mac One stuff, which is obviously just a cube, which is really it's just such a well designed. Well, it's the same interface as all the others with the grouping of the channels. If you need to use different settings for different areas of the room, that's pretty cool.
And very inexpensive usually. When they're on sale, I think currently the plugin costs like $25 or something like that, which is
they're a good bunch.
Great stuff. We're going to leave some links for those of you who are watching us on YouTube. We're going to leave some links in the description. Check out Red Rock Sound; they are doing great stuff.
Yeah, well, I did speak to one of the developers, and at the moment you can't easily use it in Plugbidule. Because maybe on Mac it might, but on Windows you can't you can't set up the it doesn't expose all of its channel capabilities properly.
Interesting.
It goes like 1, 2, 6 and 11 in Plugbidule, and you can't get to like 7.1.4 or 9.1.6 or anything, even though it's on a 16 channel kind of bus. But I think it's just that the Bidule only tells you what the plugin supports. So if the plugin doesn't report it correctly, then Plugbidule doesn't report it correctly either. So I think they're going to resolve that, which is great for Plugbidule users or anyone that uses kind of agnostic kind of workflow. It would be useful. That's it for me. I'm sure there's loads of other stuff that I've missed, but as I said, I've been busy on other stuff. Messing around with VR and virtuoso.
Yeah, we might want to at some point talk about that, because I think that's going to, that's, you know, kind of, I don't know if you guys kind of observed CES over the last week, and you know, kind of apart from the expected kind of things that we saw, like artificial intelligence. Apparently, everything is now artificial intelligence enhanced. if you don't have a fridge that doesn't have an artificial intelligence in there, you're not in. But the one thing that I did not expect was the advances in display technology, and so kind of for the first time I'm seeing displays that could actually perceivably be used for augmented reality, and that opens up really interesting possibilities in terms of how to use that in a mixing or mastering or kind of music environment, really. So it's at some point I think we should talk about that. But that's for a future episode. And for anybody watching, if you're interested in that, just let us know. And we're going to kind of move that up and talk about it sooner rather than later. I know that, Sam, you kind of experimented a little with the Quest. I did that myself as well. I think there are some really interesting things that can be done.
Yeah, definitely. But yeah, we'll talk about that another day.
Yeah, another day. Okay, so this brings us to Yannick. Well, first of all, thanks for kind of joining us. And I already said that to some extent, but when we talk about Fraunhofer, there's essentially one group usually in the international kind of mindset. There's one group that is the Fraunhofer group, and that is the group that where you are, which is the, I think, the Institute for Integrated Circuit, right?
Exactly.
But if you, for those of you who are actually kind of going to the Fraunhofer Society, there are actually kind of lots of Fraunhofer institutes. And for those of you who don't know, that is a fairly a way in Germany to fund research, and it's extremely competitive. So if you are able to kind of create a Fraunhofer Institute, that is sort of the pinnacle of your career, really, especially if you have something that kind of lasts as long. So maybe you can talk a little bit about where you guys come from, why integrated circuit, essentially how did you guys get into audio?
Yeah, that's a good question. Though we need to go back, a couple of decades ago already. So, I mean, the Fraunhofer Society, that was founded right after World War II, and so the main idea was to have a public-funded, research institute. So we are at least partially governmental funded. So we are also a non-profit organization. And the idea is to have applied research for the benefit of the society. So a couple of months ago, I read an interesting news or an interesting sentence where it says, if you want to win the Nobel Prize, you need to apply at a Max Planck Institute, for example, and Fraunhofer is where the money is coming from, or where money and is being made. So, so the idea of Fraunhofer is actually, and that's also why it is called Fraunhofer, after Josef von Fraunhofer, who was a mixture of an inventor, of an entrepreneur, and and also someone who was took research into the benefit of society and also gaining money for that. So this is why Fraunhofer is named after Josef von Fraunhofer. And so the idea is to have a research organization who is researching for the benefit of the society by applied research. And more than 30 years ago, it all started in Erlangen with the Fraunhofer Institute for Integrated Circuits. So this is where a part or a group of people started to work on integrated circuits and design of integrated circuits. And back then, a group of members of the University of Erlangen, but also from Fraunhofer, joined a group on with the idea of how is it possible to transmit audio signals over telephone networks. And this is where it all started, and this is where MP3 resulted in. And that's almost, 30 years ago, more than 30 years ago.
And MP3 and then essentially kind of really put you on the map, right? So this is where the main theme came from.
Exactly.
Because you essentially you are partly responsible for creating the internet as we know it today. Really, the streaming wouldn't exist without kind of, well, probably there would be somebody else who would have come up with something similar. But essentially, kind of, it was the groundwork that created the streaming environment that we have today.
Exactly. So that was almost 30 years ago when MP3 was invented and, of course, became a huge success. I think there's no one in the world who doesn't know about MP3. But this is actually where when the audio division has been founded, and we are now, almost 30 years ago, now 30 years later, we are now a group of about 300 researchers, and we are researching any kind of topic related to audio. Of course, there's a significant amount of people working on audio coding. But of course, there are also a lot of people working on signal processing and rendering technologies. We are also very well connected with the university, where a lot of people are doing academic work of audio or related to audio. So this is a great mixture of people with different scope, different knowledge. And this is a great working environment to come up with new ideas, work on new technologies, and shape the audio future.
I'm kind of curious, because there is still a connection to the university, obviously, but the Fraunhofer Institute is self-contained and also self-sustaining, right? So
exactly.
Do I get it right? So at some point, the expectation is that you guys are able to fund yourself. You have a couple of years in order to kind of get to the point where it essentially becomes the research becomes its own business model to some extent. That's at least the way I understood it while I was a researcher in Europe.
Exactly. So this is there's a governmental funding. So it's actually divided in three different parts. So there's a governmental funding, which is part of a grant funding. And then there's a contractual work. So we're also working with the industry. The industry reaches out to us, and we are making a collaboration and working with the industry to support them in development. And then there's also the part where we are, for example, licensing and et cetera, these kind of things, where our own technology we are inventing are being applied to gain income. And so based on those three, let's say, the parts, this is how we are working, how we are being, where the budget is coming from for us for working and researching topics.
It's absolutely fascinating how the Germans managed to kind of set it up, because I think that gives the German industry quite an advantage, that model. I'm honestly, somebody's probably going to correct me, but I'm honestly not completely sure if there's an equivalent idea here in the United States. We do have centers, so NSF, for example, does these centers, but they kind of don't function in the same way that the Fraunhofer functions. Fraunhofer really kind of is like almost like an incubator, where you essentially kind of trying to really be the translational research, kind of taking things from the universities, basic research, and kind of making that accessible. And also kind of creating a vehicle where you can actually commercialize these technologies in the industry. I'm very surprised that nobody picked it up, at least not to my knowledge, but you probably kind of know that better than I do.
And there's there's so much, let's say, groundbreaking research, and then finally also product development coming out of Fraunhofer. So of course the audio coding is something which everybody knows, but there's also like video coding, which is very famous worldwide, which is also with essential contribution from Fraunhofer. There's, for example, the white LED, which is also coming from Fraunhofer, or with significant contribution from Fraunhofer. So there's a lot of technology which affects the daily life of everyone, which has the roots at Fraunhofer.
Just out of curiosity, the video is not in your group. Is it also your group or?
We do have a video department. They are also working, especially with moving pictures department, essentially also working on the cinematic field. But we do have also an institute which is based in Berlin, which is researching the picture compression, like H.264, H.265, H.266, and so on. That's a institute based in Berlin. But we do have, institutes. I think now it's about 77, if I'm not wrong. So above 70 different institutes, kind of really researching any kind of topic you can imagine. And they are spread all over Germany, always very well connected to the university to have this, what you already described, this academic background, and also a lot of talented new students and new employees coming directly from university to bring in innovation. And we also do have a couple of partners worldwide. We do have some offices in different parts of the world. So it's also a very international team, which makes it very, very nice for,
Does the industry drive the research more than the research kind of drives the industry, or is it a two-way kind of collaboration, would you say, for
I think that
what product ends up in reality?
It's definitely a collaboration, but it really depends also on the field where you're working in. So even inside the audio division, there are groups of people really working with the industry and only with the industry to contribute with their technology and also develop together with the industry technologies. Yeah. But on the other hand, there's also a lot of people working on, the base of future developments, which is by now not really connected to the industry, but of course with the target that on a long term, this will end up in a product. So this really depends on the field of research where you currently look at. So it's hard to answer that.
Yeah, no, totally. Yeah, no, thanks.
Yeah. When I kind of prepared a little for this podcast, because I do prepare, I looked at your website and kind of, honestly, I thought there's maybe like half a dozen Fraunhofer Institutes, because I do know that. And I was actually surprised. You said like 77, it's a long list. So the amount of work that is done there is really remarkable. It's really remarkable. There are so many institutes that you guys actually have a prize, right? So there's like the Josef von Fraunhofer Prize, and you guys won that, right?
We won that last year in 2023 for MPEG-H. Also the years before, we have the Fraunhofer IIS won a couple of projects and products that prize. So it's not the first time the audio division is winning the prize, but of course for us and especially for me, that was a very nice prize we won last year. And as you said, that's from the society, so from the headquarters. They are giving this prize for for the products and the teams who are, fulfilling the mindset of Fraunhofer, meaning doing basic research, bring that into a product, and then bring that into the market to help society and gain revenue based on that. So, and this is where we last year won the prize for MPEG-H.
I would think so. I found that fascinating because, kind of it's already extremely competitive to get the Fraunhofer Institute started, and then it doesn't stop there. Once you're in that, you still are competing against each other. So it's like the ultimate competition, which shows, quite frankly. And this brings us to MPEG-H, and that's why you're here. Can you tell us a little bit what is MPEG-H and how did it come about?
Yeah, so MPEG-H is actually a codec, or actually audio system in the fourth generation of audio codecs from Fraunhofer IIS. So as I said, we started decades ago with MP3, that was the first generation, then the successor AAC, Advanced Audio Coding, I guess less people have heard about that compared to MP3, but probably equal amount of people using it, probably without knowing. But so that's
I also didn't know that either, that's coming from Fraunhofer. I was not aware of that for some reason. AAC.
Yeah, cool. Exactly. Advanced audio coding. And then the third generation of that is then high efficiency advanced audio coding, which is also in billions of devices.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're on the fourth generation. And among others, there's MPEG-H, but there's, for example, also the successor of HEAAC, which is called Extended High Efficiency AAC, XHEAAC. since I'm from the team working on MPEG-H, we can focus on that. And this is, of course, the topic of today's podcast. So what is MPEG-H? So MPEG-H is not only an audio codec, where in the past it was all about data reduction. Now we are talking about a full audio system, actually. And MPEG-H brings, compared to, let's say, the old audio codecs or traditional audio codecs, three big advantages. And the first one is immersive sound. So this is something we have heard already. So I guess most of the people are familiar with immersive sound. And this is, of course, including not only a surround layer, but also adding a height. And when we are talking about height, we're not only talking about like positive elevation, we're also talking about negative elevation. So that means floor level sound, for example. So this is something MPEG-H can support. And when we're talking about layouts, in MPEG-H, this is quite flexible. So we are not only focusing a single, channel-based or loudspeaker layout, but we have hundreds of different layouts which are possible. And this, this opportunity of immersive sound, this can be carried out in different ways in MPEG-H. And the first one is pure channel-based. So this is what we all know, where each channel is represented by a loudspeaker signal. Then we do have object-based audio, and this is also something I will talk in a second. So basically audio elements with metadata. And we also have scene-based audio or ambisonics. This is all of those three are supported in MPEG-H or a combination of all of those three. And so that was the first big advantage the difference of MPEG-H. The second one is personalization. And this is something where we think is the big advantage of MPEG-H audio, since what I already mentioned with channels and objects, we do can allow the user to personalize the audio experience. And this is all under control by the content creator and defined in metadata. And that means that, for example, we can increase the dialogue of, drama series compared to the background. That means better speech intelligibility. When we think about today, you actually need to increase the volume of the whole, mix, but that does not improve the speech intelligibility. With MPEG-H, you can only increase the dialogue, for example, or you can have advanced audio description for accessibility purposes. But of course, we can go in much more creative ways. For example, we can allow the users to enable or disable a preferred commentator in a sports match, or we can have, for example, in a car race, the users could switch on the team radio in order to let them listen to the communication between the crew and the driver. So these are all possibilities you can do with MPEG-H, and it's only, the creative possibilities you can explore are endless. And then the third big advantage, so going back, immersive sound, personalization, the third one is what we are calling the universal delivery, and that means we are not focusing on the several productions, like producing for the various reproduction layouts and regions and different versions of a mix, but we can actually use the channel-based and object-based approach to make sure plus metadata, of course, to ensure that on the end consumer device, the best possible sound quality will always be rendered. And this is achieved by having a very sophisticated renderer and the receiving device who knows what's coming in and who knows about the possibilities of the reproduction layout. And then this renderer applies all the audio processing to make sure that no information gets lost. There's no, let's say, comp filtering or energy variations when you do a rendering to a lower loudspeaker layout, for example, from an immersive mix to stereo. But you can also, for example, have binaural rendering on the end consumer device. So we can always ensure, based on the availability of the end consumer, that this one mix a producer is doing is sounding in the best way possible for the various reproduction layouts. So as I said, it's not only a codec itself, and of course the data reduction, so the algorithm to reduce bitrate is the best one in the market. But it's based on that ground, it's even possible to have more and more features, which makes it an audio system rather than an audio codec.
I think the personalization is an interesting one, because, you know, kind of in music production, we usually don't really talk about these things, you know, kind of. I was just thinking about, I was watching Christopher Nolan's Tenet with my sons, and it was impossible to watch, because essentially you had only two options: either not understanding what they were talking about, or kind of really kind of making an earthquake in our living room. And kind of having this personalization option to kind of do that, I think that is really interesting, and that's something that I think Dolby Atmos does not have, for example. So this is the big thing. MPEG-H has different levels, right? So you guys decided to. Can you tell us a little bit about what that is and why you did it that way?
Sure. Yeah. So. When we're talking about MPEG-H, we're actually talking about an open standard. So MPEG is a consortium of various companies. And within MPEG, there's always the definition of certain levels of an audio codec to define complexity. So that means the MPEG-H audio standard itself supports up to 128 channel or objects as an input format or coding format. And then 64 of them those can be rendered to up to 64 loudspeakers. But since this is quite complex for, let's say, companies implementing the codec with reduced amount of calculation complexity on a chip, for example, so what happens is that MPEG defines several levels in order to standardize complexity. And that means, for example, in the streaming and broadcast world, where the majority of people are in, we are talking about MPEG-H level 3, which supports up to 32 channels or objects as an input, while 16 of them can be decoded at the same time, up to 12 loudspeaker channels. And for example, that means you can have a variation of 5.1 plus 4 beds, let's say, so like background ambient signals plus additional objects. And the users can, for example, choose from one ambience to another, so they are not both being decoded at the same time. So that's why we come up from 32 to go down to 16. And there are also other levels which are, for example, being used in other countries, like, for example, in Japan, where 22.2 plays a major role. There's MPEG-H level 4, which supports up to 56 channels as an input, while 32 are being decoded up to 22.2. So there are various, let's say, those definitions in order to make sure that we have a same page for the complexity of implementers and users to use MPEG-H.
Michael.
Go ahead.
So I'm aware there's kind of MPEG-H 3D, and then there's MPEG-H, do you call it IMS, immersive? Is kind of like a VR and a broadcast kind of version of it? Or is that all just considered a layer of MPEG-H?
MPEG-H is actually a family of standards. And there are several parts of MPEG-H. So when we're talking about audio, to be actually very precise, we are talking about MPEG-H part 3, 3D audio.
Right.
But of course, there's a transport part of MPEG-H, MMT, for instance. And there's also a video part. So you might have heard about H265, high efficiency video coding. That's also part of MPEG-H. So when we're talking about audio, we're actually talking only about part 3 of the MPEG-H standard.
Okay. And then the layers are within just the audio part. Yeah. It's not crossing over to other areas. Yeah. Okay. I see. Yeah. No, thanks.
Yeah. You guys provide the tools for people for free. So essentially, if somebody wants to work with MPEG-H, they can simply go to your site and then essentially make a purchase for $0, really. That's what it is. I think that was one of the reasons why we got into contact, because that tool set essentially works with level 3. Sorry, right? So kind of, I'm kind of curious, because you said in Japan they're using level 4. Are there any tools out there that kind of where normal people can also access kind of higher levels of MPEG-H audio?
Yeah. So I'm glad that you mentioned that. And when we're talking about the tools itself, I mean, this is also based on the background of Fraunhofer and also having this open standard. So we are, on the first hand, we are developing tools to provide them for free in order to let the community explore the possibilities of MPEG-H. But of course, we also do work with partners on integrating MPEG-H capabilities in their tools, and that be it for live or also for post-production. And so, for example, there are a bunch of tools also supporting, let's say, sophisticated 3D panning tools, which overcome limitations of audio workstations and so on. So where you can pan hundreds of channels into a channel bed and then enhance it with objects. But the tool you mentioned, so this is the MPEG-H authoring suite. This is a free download from our website. And that actually supports partially level 4 already. So you can also make use of MPEG-H level 4 if you are wanting to produce in 22.2. But of course, it comes with certain limitations that some decoders which are on the market are not supporting level 4 based on the regions. And I also want to emphasize the fact that MPEG-H level 3 actually is also something we have considered as a practical approach for the industry, as, for example, the broadcast and streaming world is still based on SDI. And so for live applications, an SDI is capable of working or carrying 16 audio channels. And this is also where this limitation is coming from. So we can make actually use of those 16 channels for a bed and additional objects in order to carry them inside the current studio infrastructure without the need of significant investments. So yeah, this is where this limitation is also coming from. But there are tools out there supporting also level 4. For example, the Spatial Audio Designer. I don't know if you are familiar with that tool.
I am.
This is a tool which also supports MPEG-H level 4 in an experimental mode.
Okay.
I'm always with the disclaimer that it might happen that the decoders out there are not supporting the level 4. So this is why we are always a bit, let's say, careful when recommending level 4. But in general, of course, this is working. And also I just wanted to add, since we are talking about free tools, that's also something which is a bit, let's say, special in MPEG-H in an open standard. For example, there's also the decoder of MPEG-H is available for free download on GitHub. So everybody who's a bit familiar with programming and so on or wants to check that out can go on GitHub and download the decoder and start to implement the decoder in their own player or in their own environment to make use of MPEG-H. So there's actually a whole chain available for free or for free download. Starting from production tools up to the decoder.
Yeah, no, kind of. That is one of the things that for those of you who haven't seen it, I recently did like two videos where I talked about MPEG Agent. One of the things that I said is sort of this limitation of 16 channels. And I think after talking to you, sort of it became clear that this was a conscious decision also to make sure that this is actually usable. And for that particular target audience that you guys actually have developed this particular standard, I think that is a very practical kind of limitation. But it's kind of interesting to know that that essentially higher levels are possible if you are willing to accept sort of the risks that you're taking by kind of going into routes that you might not be able to kind of decode correctly. It's a very German approach, I think, to kind of start with the standardization and then sort of kind of look at and make this standardization as flexible as possible, because MPEG Edge by itself, the standard, has enormous flexibility. You know, kind of there's anything, everything is in there that you would possibly want. And then sort of kind of have the community give them the possibility to actually implement the tools to go with it.
Yeah, and exactly, that describes it very well. And I also want to emphasize the fact that it's something which is sometimes a bit misleading when we're talking about channels and objects and those kind of things. For us, an object is always something which comes with the flexibility in terms of metadata to not only being rendered independently from a channel bed in a three-dimensional space, but also allow the user to interact with, if allowed by the content creator. And again, this is defined in production in a so-called authoring step, and then carried on as metadata along with the audio signal. And of course, with the tools available out there, there's also the possibility of actually use hundreds of channels and pan them in a 3D space. And those hundred of, let's say, objects, if you want to call it that way, and they are then being rendered to loudspeaker signals, and then actually what is being encoded in MPEG H is then this channel rendering, for example, to 514. And then in addition, we might want to have an audio object, for example, a commentator, not being part of the channel bed, but being kept separate for allowing personalization. So this is why, and that's a different approach from what we are doing compared to other technologies. So we want to have the producers having the full control of their mix and making sure what stays an object for being rendered as an object on the receiver and what goes into a channel bed during the part of the production and then being encoded as a channel inside MPEG H. And this is a bit, let's say, a different philosophy compared to other technologies where they have a lot of objects, and then they are actually being rendered during the encoding process and then also being delivered as channels.
Yeah, I find that interesting. I don't think I got that originally kind of when I first looked at that, but sort of this idea to kind of look at objects as something that really is part of the production process rather than kind of the delivery process, right? So that is actually interesting. And we talked about that before essentially kind of went into recording this podcast. I'm coming from a game audio perspective, and in game audio, everything is an object, right? And the game engine actually kind of decides on how to put that together in order to make a Dolby Atmos object. It was interesting to me to get a little bit into that philosophy. And I think that comes primarily because your target audience is, I would think, in the audiovisual space, really. So it's film, TV, these types of things, right?
Exactly. I mean, the principal idea of the MPEG-H standard when the call for proposal happened, also more than 10 years ago already, the idea was to create or standardize the best technologies to fulfill the current needs of audiovisual media consumption. So basically meet the requirements of involving streaming market and OTT market and those kind of things. But at the same time, of course, also ensures that broadcast applications are being, traditional broadcast applications are being met in its requirements. So the MPEG-H standard is, as you said, is really, let's say, focusing on those streaming and broadcast market, but at the same time also is being used as a codec for delivery of immersive music services. Like, for example, 360 Reality Audio is based on MPEG-H, or is actually MPEG-H, the codec behind it. And due to the fact that it's so flexible in terms of objects and also rendering as well as data reduction. So and this is exactly what you mentioned, that there's a bit the difference in philosophy compared to other technologies where they might coming from cinema or the game industry, where we were really focusing on the streaming and broadcast market.
Do you see on the music side, it's very much a Sony end user consumed side to MPEG-H. Do you see that changing in the future in terms of, I'm just thinking out loud, maybe a way that just a bedroom mixer could somehow stream their own music in MPEG-H to some sort of platform without the commercial kind of tie-in to Sony or Tidal or Amazon or whatever. I think that's definitely an area that I think would really excite a lot of people. Would be some, because even though Ambisonics has been around for 60 years, there's still really not a way for anybody to consume it in a non academic kind of sense. I think that would be really, really cool. The Sony stuff's great, and it's always great fun to listen to it. But you always think, well, okay, I've got to publish it through Sony's production kind of suite alternative. I don't know what your thoughts are on that. Obviously, there is the link in with Sony, so that might restrict how open it could be. But I don't know.
Well, actually, that's the beauty of an open standard. Everybody can adopt the standard. So of course we are collaborating with Sony, obviously, since we are one of the main contributors to the MPEG-H audio standard and the audio system. There are also others, and Sony is one of them. But of course we are collaborating with them on the 360 RA ecosystem. But that does not limit the technology to only be an exclusive technology for the 360 RA ecosystem. For anyone who is interested in adopting the open standard, can adopt the standard, building their own technologies, building their own ecosystem. Of course, and there's much more features in MPEG-H possible than currently being used in 360 Reality Audio. Because Sony decided to design the system according to their needs. But of course, the interactive part of MPEG-H is something currently not possible in 360 RA and might be, can offer interesting features for also for the music industry. For example, like, karaoke versions, alternative mixes, a house mix versus an acoustic mix of the same the same song. There's a bunch of possibility yet to be explored.
A clean and an explicit version, if you're kind of in the United States, right? That's fascinating. That's fascinating. There's a lot of unexplored potential there. Now, in the music space, everything is Dolby Atmos right now, right? I'm kind of wondering, well, essentially kind of there's all this talk about Apple requiring people to submit in Dolby Atmos and things like that. Why should people use MPEG-H as opposed to Dolby Atmos? So what's your take on that? Or how do you see the relationship with Dolby Atmos? Let's put it that way, a little less confrontational.
Of course, on the one hand, there's Dolby Atmos out there for the music industry, but there's also 360 Reality Audio out there for the music industry, and it's according to, users' preference or labels or whoever is deciding in which format to produce. I think this is the decision of all the producers out there. When it comes to the benefits of MPEG-H over Atmos, I mean, and as you already said, the big advantage of that is the personalization aspect. And if you don't want to go into the personalization aspect, only the codec itself, that means the algorithm for data reduction, is already quite significantly better in MPEG-H than in Atmos. But with a disclaimer that Atmos is, of course, a brand name, so it's always hard to really, let's say what codec is behind Atmos. So when you ask me on how to differentiate MPEG-H versus Atmos, I actually need to ask back, what do you mean in terms of codec when you talk about Atmos?
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yep. Yeah. It depends how you listen to it as well. What codec you end up using. Like Android is like the AC4, or Apple would be the DD+.
I mean, you are in some sort, you are right? Kind of there are certain things in Dolby Atmos that you really don't kind of take advantage of, you know, kind of the ability to have like 128 objects or 118 objects. I see many people struggle with that. Also the fact that once you kind of go that route, because the objects are kind of are decoded after the production process, you're losing this idea of a mastering kind of environment. Whereas in MPEG-H, you could actually do that. We were talking about the Redrock sound plugins. You can actually kind of set that at front of the MPEG-H authoring plugin, and then you essentially have a mastering kind of approach. So there are certain advantages that might actually give it a cutting edge, kind of might give it an advantage over Atmos, but the industry seems to kind of go Dolby Atmos these days.
Right? Well, I mean, when we're talking about the music industry, most likely. However, I don't think that there's a final decision made already. I mean, this is, I think, a current, let's say, snapshot of the industry, but which is, of course, changing while we're talking, most likely. Of course, I mean, there's Dolby Atmos is a brand name, which is, of course, quite strong. And there's MPEG-H as a, let's say, as an open standard from a nonprofit, or mainly with main contribution from a nonprofit organization. So there are different philosophies, different background on how to approach the industry. While we are also focusing a bit on, let's say, different applications, while actually the main competitor to MPEG-H would be AC4, the codec from Dolby, which is not so widely spread in the market yet. So this is, of course, it's also sometimes branded as Dolby Atmos. This is why I ask back, what do you mean with Dolby Atmos?
Yeah, you're right.
But when we're talking about Dolby Atmos music, then as Sam and you already mentioned, so we're talking mainly about DD+ Chalk or AC4 IMS.
AC4 is only the headphone style playback. So it's always quite difficult to kind of judge where Atmos actually is in the music industry, because it's so... Dolby and Apple are so tied in with the professional studio side of it that you don't know how much is it, you know, just because there's a relationship there, and how much is it because they really want to make Atmos music. It's always a little bit difficult to understand how strong actually is it, because it's kind of underneath a blanket of it's brilliant, it's all around you sort of kind of talk, but there's not actually much. There's not much drive behind why people are saying it's popular. It's very difficult to judge, I think. But it's not an open standard, so it's very difficult to know what is going on, really, to some extent.
Exactly. Yeah, and also for me personally, I mean, knowing what immersive sound, especially, and also object-based audio can actually deliver, and what foreign quality of audio experience you can achieve with that, then it's always for me also quite frustrating, honestly, when listening to, for example, Atmos on Apple Music, because there's so much songs out there, which honestly, for my, but my personal opinion is that they are really not well mixed. So sometimes I have the feeling that people just, when they deliver a mix, they just need to check mark the box on delivered in Atmos. And this might be produced as, I don't know, with some upmixing tools or I have no idea how it's being produced, but at least from the production or from the quality of the mix itself, this is something which I would personally not see a benefit for immersive audio, knowing how immersive audio can actually sound like with a proper, let's say, listening environment, with a proper mix. And this is something where I personally hope that the mass market being capable one day to really also being able to enjoy the possibilities of immersive sound rather than what's being currently being mainstreamly used.
I don't know. To a certain extent, Atmos has gone through that, or is still at that point where there's a blur of is this just kind of a stereo plus kind of upmix, or is this actually immersive? And even at the professional level, there's quite a lot of kind of just placing stereo and mono things in space versus actually thinking in a more of an immersive sense where you're actually placing 3D objects in a 3D space rather than 2D in a 3D space. So that's I think that's where MPEG-H certainly is a little bit more attractive, because there's more metadata about the kind of the playback rather than Dolby, which is more just about how is it panned and the binaural kind of side to it. So definitely more powerful.
And there's in MPEG-H, there's so much more metadata being defined, coming from that, from the idea of delivering the best possible audio quality for media consumption. Yeah. And so the metadata, the set of metadata is so much more sophisticated. So we, for example, did not talk about loudness in DRC, which is mandatory in MPEG-H. So that means that, that for example, user after user personalization, the loudness is still being preserved while maintaining the artistic intent. So this is a very sophisticated algorithm of making use of loudness and dynamic range control, which is part of the MPEG-H metadata. Then there's like very interesting metadata, for example, for when we're talking about multi-languages. So for example, for ducking, let's say you have a multi-language approach, so you're delivering multiple languages. So how do you duck a bat when you don't know what the user has actually selected at home? So you cannot really, let's say, have an English commentator, and when the English commentator is active, the background is being ducked. When the user is listening, or when the viewers at home are listening to a Spanish commentator. So this is also a set of metadata which can be defined in MPEG-H, where you set something which is called a dynamic gain or a gain sequence, where you are actually defining the attenuation and the attack and release and everything based on the user selection. And this attenuation is being rendered on the end consumer device rather than being produced, but of course being monitored while production and defined in those metadata set. So this is something where MPEG-H has so much, let's say, more sophisticated metadata, which makes it actually the most flexible audio system in the market right now. And it's just, I'm not saying that only because I work for MPEG-H and for Fraunhofer. It is true.
I think anyone that downloads the, the production tools would see quite quickly how much more kind of control about what you're doing exists at the production level, whereas with the Dolby side, a lot of it's just kind of taken away, or you don't have any control over a lot of the Atmos side of it. It's very much kind of fixed in stone almost at the ADM stage, other than a little bit on the kind of loudness side and stuff, but it's quite basic really.
Very interesting. I mean, one of the things that I always wonder is And you kind of alluded to that a little bit, because people are starting to get frustrated that the immersive experience that they're getting out of an Apple Atmos isn't really particularly, you know, kind of enticing. Let's call it that way. So it's a lot of people question. But what I'm seeing on the Dolby Atmos side is that a lot of studios are making, and that actually kind of is one of the things where I think Dolby is doing a good job in making sure that the producers are sort of invested in that technology and then essentially can't really kind of leave that technology again. Because if you're spending like $200,000 into a studio that is Dolby Atmos certified, then you almost have to kind of to Dolby Atmos. So kind of this advantage that MPEG-H has, that it is so super flexible to some extent, is also a disadvantage, because Dolby can simply kind of push the branding, right?
Exactly. And I mean, that's also the beauty of MPEG-H, that it's being so flexible. So it also means, for example, from a production perspective, if people are being, forced to produce in Atmos, be it for music or also for streaming or broadcast applications, there's also a way of converting that signal into MPEG-H. So on the production side, so for example, we can take the master file of Atmos, the broadcast waveform with ADM. So we can actually take that, convert it into an MPEG-H capable master format, and it can be either also MPEG-H ADM or the so-called MPEG-H production format. And taking all the mixes from an Atmos mix can then be easily converted in the production step, can be enhanced with MPEG-H, with unique MPEG-H features. For example, a conversion tool, we can take 128 channels and objects Atmos mix, and then convert this into a channel renderings while keeping or while preserving audio objects with its position data, and allow then user personalization, for example, on the dialogue for and giving or providing a version which is 100% identical to the mix of Atmos, while adding, for example, a version with enhanced dialogue for people with problems for hearing or with hearing impediments. So, and this can be an automatic process, or this can be a manual process if producers wants to have the final decision on the mix itself. But it's actually a rather simple tweak for taking an existing Atmos and converting that into an MPEG-H and then deliver something more personalized for users.
Yeah. So you said there are tools for that or kind of?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
There are, for example, tools which are part of the MPEG-H offering suite. That's so-called the MPEG-H conversion tool. That's for free download. Or example, in the Nuendo implementation of MPEG-H. Mm-hmm. So since Nuendo 13, there's a support of MPEG-H. You can also import an Atmos ADM file and then define what's being rendered into a channel bed, what stays as an object, and then you can enhance that's the objects with additional metadata. So there are several ways on how to do that.
Yeah, the kind of I didn't realize that the conversion tool allows you to read in Dolby Atmos, but sort of that's my fault. I kind of didn't see that. But Nuendo, yeah, that can do that. Which actually brings me to a question that I had is the integration of MPEG-H into Nuendo probably was a big thing, I would think. Can we expect that this integration is going to come to different digital audio workstations as well?
Yes, I mean, for us, it was a major achievement to have this level of integration into Nuendo. There was a great collaboration with the colleagues at Steinberg. We're also working with other audio workstation manufacturers. So since mid of last year, we also have the support of MPEG-H in Pro Tools. That means that you can actually download the plugin for MPEG-H for free from Avid Play. And we are also we communicated that this is just the start of a longer collaboration. We are also expecting to have a more integrated MPEG-H authoring capability and production capability into Pro Tools. And we're working with others such as Blackmagic Design, which also have support of MPEG-H.
Yeah, it's very integrated in DaVinci Resolve. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a bunch of audio workstation already out there, and of course we're working with all those partners to enhance the user experience. And
I know what does come up quite a lot with the Atmos engineers that are also Sony 360 engineers as well, is I think they've, because you mentioned the ADM to an MPEG-H conversion, but I think they would love a either an MPEG-H to Atmos or a Sony 360 to Atmos or an Atmos to Sony 360, but I don't think that workflow is quite possible. But that's probably more to do with Sony than anything.
It is also the problem of Atmos. I mean, there's a multi-layer, let's say multi-layer robins in that, but of course MPEG-H allows it, what I already mentioned, much more metadata, which are not being reflected in Atmos. So that's easy why you can convert Atmos into MPEG-H, because the metadata set of MPEG-H is fully capable of taking in an Atmos.
It encapsulates,
but the other way is more complicated, so you would lose a lot of information. And then the question is, what you need to strip down things. So you're losing a lot of information, and that's something that means it's just not capable of, taking all the metadata information.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. Yeah, you can't fit more data into, you can't fit more data into less of an ADM.
MPEG-H is simply the richer format, right? So there's more possibilities.
That's a one-way street.
I thought it was interesting that, because I've snooped a little bit on the MPEG on the Sony 360 that comes from Tidal. And that is delivered as a certain MPEG-H layer, I think. And it looks like it will decode to 7.1.4, maybe. So is that right? It kind of looks like, even though I guess a lot of people get a headphone kind of rendering of it, it looks like theoretically it's speaker-based as well.
It depends. I mean, in 360 Reality Audio is a pure object-based format, so they are not using channels; they are using objects only.
Okay.
And then it takes the advantage of MPEG-H being so flexible. It depends on what you are actually listening to on the end consumer device. So this 24 objects being either rendered to a channel layout or being rendered discretely to a binaural signal. That really depends on where you listen to and what's your capabilities of your playback device.
Okay, so similar to an Atmos delivery, where if you're on an Android phone, you only get like the binaural, or if you were on a speaker-based system, you would get the AC3 DD Plus or whatever. Doing it all within the same codec. That's the difference, yeah.
Well, and you're always doing objects. So you're only delivering objects. So you're always keeping the best resolution available and then render that on the end consumer device. While in Atmos, you do a rendering in advance, send out channels, and then being decoded to channel-based approach.
Gotcha, interesting.
No. It's one of the things that frustrates me a little bit about Sony 360 is they have a very, at least I kind of felt it, is that relatively high barrier of entry, really, because the tools are quite expensive, right? They're even more expensive than the renderer, which I thought was a little unfortunate, because I think a lot of people would really be interested in kind of going the Sony 360 route.
Yep. That's true. Yeah. Unfortunately, that's a decision done by Sony. Of course, maybe that changes in the future. I also hope so. Because it just, opens up the market, as you said, wider. If you open up the production tools in a sense that people are using that.
Yeah.
Although the production tool itself, the WalkMix Creator, is a quite nice tool, if you ask me. Yeah, it's a quite sophisticated 3D tool with very nice features. But my feeling is that
a lot of these companies are not really kind of targeting their market correctly, right? So if you We had a lot of discussion about the Studio One implementation of Dolby Atmos, which is exceptionally straightforward, right? So this opens up Dolby Atmos to essentially anybody who has a computer, really, right? Mm-hmm. When I'm talking about Sony 360, the story is different, right? So there's a financial barrier. It's a lot more complex. It's a bit unfortunate, at least I think, that many of these companies are not really targeting the bedroom producers, that are essentially the ones that are producing the TikTok audio and the YouTube audio and these types of things. The 12-year-old in his bedroom, right? Because that is would be much more beneficial, I think.
Yeah, that's something. And a question you need to forward to Sony. But in principle, I agree. But that's a decision done by Sony. So that's just a different approach to the market.
Right. So the business decisions, unfortunately, we have no influence on that, right? I need to look at the time a little because we are kind of approaching on our kind of final couple of minutes. But there's one thing that I wanted to kind of talk about at the end, and that is sort of what is the future of MPEG-H? And you mentioned to me something that's called MPEG-I. So maybe you can also allude on that a little, what that is.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, of course, future of MPEG-H is first of all that we are also targeting streaming and broadcast industry, and we want to personalize the audio experience for a lot of people out there. But of course, also in MPEG, there's always an improvement of technologies and development of standards. And MPEG-H, of course, is not the last standard done in MPEG. So the next one is called MPEG-I. And MPEG-I is especially targeting 6 degrees of freedom or VR and AR application or XR application. The good news is the base on that is actually, again, MPEG-H audio. So MPEG-H audio being part of MPEG-I. With an enhanced metadata set and with an enhanced renderer, and that especially is targeting, for example, as I already mentioned, let's say a 6 degrees of freedom application where you can have a rich set of metadata for, let's say, in the acoustic environment. So you can define objects inside, let's say, a space or in a virtual environment. And then also have acoustic properties, which are set in metadata. And then when people are moving in a 6 degrees of freedom environment, and they hide behind an obstacle inside a room, then the audio signal being rendered and transmitted in this room is being also considered as, you know, the acoustical environment, and the obstacle is then taken into account while the signal is being rendered. So it's a very sophisticated audio technology for 6 degrees of freedom, AR, XR applications, and so on.
Occlusion. Yeah, is that what they call that? Occlusion, yeah? Occlusion, is that right? Yeah.
Yeah, it's sort of, you know, kind of that's where I come from mainly, right? So kind of my department, we have a virtual reality program and a game design program and these types of things. So kind of these, what they're telling me there is super exciting, and the fact that MPEG-H is so if you're interested in these type of technologies that are going to become available over the next couple of years, then MPEG-H is your safe bet because you can essentially kind of have something that will be compatible with MPEG-I later down the road. So this is actually very, very interesting, very enticing, something I kind of really like.
Yeah, and MPEG-I is still in the standardization phase. Mm-hmm. So this is also one of the reasons you might not came across implementations of MPEG-I yet. But of course, this is something we are expecting to happen in the next couple of years. That more and more products and adopters of the technology is bringing MPEG-I to the market, and then also to more people out there.
Yeah, it's sort of the I have a couple of YouTube videos where I have a tutorial about Audio Kinetic Wise, which is audio middleware for game development, and this is actually one of the questions I get most frequently. How do I do occlusion, right? So how do I work with audio in a space Because the visuals now are almost hyper realistic, right? So you can, I mean, what you can do with Unreal Engine is spectacular these days. But the audio part is sort of lacking. You still need to kind of work around the limitations that you have when it comes to audio. Mm. So this I think is super exciting, and that's something that you can't really do with Dolby Atmos. And quite frankly, also not really with Ambisonics. So that's something where you need an approach like MPGI.
Not to plug a rival podcast or anything, but one of your colleagues, Yannick, was on the Immersive Audio podcast. And they, he was talking about MPEG-I. Fascinating, actually. It kind of goes way beyond just occlusion and into like AI and kind of room modeling and dimensions and all sorts of stuff, possibly. So, yeah.
Exactly.
Very fascinating interview, yeah.
Yeah, fascinating technology. If you came across that, have a chance to listen to it, it's quite impressive, yeah.
Yeah, I look forward to that, yeah.
Okay, so we are at the end of our allocated time. Sam, Yannick, is there anything that you guys wanted to discuss that we did not discuss yet?
I think we covered quite a lot there.
Yeah, we covered quite a lot, and kind of it's very exciting, right?
Yeah. I would definitely recommend, because it's essentially it's free. Definitely download the production tools from MPEG-H3D. It's a valuable kind of, well, it just gives you an insight into other ways of working as well, which is can always help in both MPEG-H and even stereo workflows, I find. Sometimes I use the tools just to get kind of a certain feeling out of the audio in an immersive sense, even if I'm not even going to be using it in an immersive way. It's quite, but you've still got the production file there if you do want to come back to it at a later point. It's quite a cool way to work. Yeah. Different workflows, quite a different sort of classic panner renderer type workflow. But once you kind of accept that, it's quite an integrated way to work, I find. So yeah, definitely that'd be my parting words.
Yannick, any final words before we close?
Yeah, I can only second what Sam says. So I can just invite everyone to download the tools and play around with them. Especially just if you want to listen to an immersive mix being binaurally rendered, for example. So this works quite easy. You have the conversion tools. You have really a bunch of tools to explore and also make yourself familiar with that technology, which I think is very powerful. Have a look at the GitHub repository if you be a bit into programming and want to make use of the decoder in a player, for instance. So I can recommend exploring MPEG-H. It's a fascinating technology, and I'm just thank you for the opportunity of being part of your podcast, and looking forward to more to come.
Thank you for being here. This was absolutely fascinating. By the way, I'm really curious where all major audio developments come out of Germany. Is there any particular reason for that?
It's good engineering, a good education, good engineering. a very long tradition in audio engineering. And I think this is just the newer generation. We can just make use of the expertise gained over decades.
Okay, so for everybody watching this on YouTube, we're going to leave some links in the description below. I can only echo what Sam and Yannick have said. Download the MPEG-H production tools. It's really remarkable. It's a very easy entry into immersive audio. You just need something like Reaper and kind of these tools, and you can get started. It's very, very inexpensive to kind of get your feet wet into immersive audio. It is future-proof because, as we have heard, MPEG-I will be more or less kind of compatible with MBGH, so you can be sure that whatever you're doing is going to have relevance in the future as well. And for those of you who are kind of listening to us on Spotify, Apple, or whatever, you can kind of go to our YouTube channel, and there you will find the links. The YouTube channel is Spatial Audio Monthly on YouTube. Just go to YouTube and search for Spatial Audio Monthly, and you will find that. And other than that, I think that's everything that we wanted to say. This is the January episode. We're going to come back next month in the February episode. There's NUM in between, so sometime we are probably going to expect a couple of new developments over the next couple of weeks. I think that's everything that I wanted to say. So kind of see you, everybody,
for the next
podcast.
Cheerio.
Thank you.